Good afternoon. I'm going to call us to order, even if we're expecting a few more people. I find the only way of getting people into good habits is to keep good habits myself. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at USIP, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to this event on Should the International Community Do Post-Conflict State Building? Today is my doubting day. I started this morning with a very interesting discussion of, are peace and justice compatible? Should we be doing both? Should we be doing one in preference to the other? And this afternoon I'm doubting whether we should do state building. So it's my doubting day. And I think it's good every once in a while to challenge our assumptions, to challenge the way we do things, and to develop better ways of doing them. And that, I think, is the purpose of the panel this afternoon, which is based in part on a book that Chuck Call has edited called Building States to Build Peace. If you haven't seen it, we don't actually sell other people's books around the Institute, so I think you probably have to go to a website to get this one, but it's a very interesting book of case studies and more thematic treatments of state building efforts, and it does raise the question, should we be doing this? We're going to start with Chuck, who will frame some of those difficult questions for us. We'll then go to Sarah Cliff, who's going to bring her experience from the World Bank, in particular now as Director of Strategy and Operations for East Asia and Pacific Region, but she was also previously the bank's fragile and conflict affected head of the bank's fragile and conflict affected countries group. International organizations have a way of stringing together words that's almost impossible to get them out. The third will be Ken Menkhouse, who brings to us an enormous expertise on Somalia, which has certainly been one of the more challenging state building situations in the world for several decades now. And Karen Van Hippel, our colleague at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, will make sure that we haven't forgotten anything. Chuck, you want to lead us off? I think it's better if people speak from here for the initial presentations, and we can take questions.
You might want to have to stay.
That's good.
Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me? Good. Thank you all for coming, and thank our panelists also for being here. If you are interested, there are order forms for the book from Lynn Reiner on the table outside, as well as a table of contents and so forth. I am going to basically just start with giving you a little context for the book that we wrote, and then end up trying to answer the question that's posed in the title of this panel, should the international community do post-conflict state building? The context for book is a project of the International Peace Institute in New York, actually, that we were all involved in. And it came at a time, it was very much focused on this sort of UN peace building and peacekeeping machinery. About 4 years ago, was very focused on, sort of increasingly focused on state building. And it was a moment of time where everyone was running to state building in the peace world as well as in the development world, initially in the development world at that time, I think. And I think the initial premise of this book project was very optimistic about the answer to our question that, yes, this is state building is the way to go in terms of peace building. And I think through the, independent of what happened out there, in the process of our putting the book together, I, at least, and some of the people involved in the project, I think, developed more nuanced positions on this question. And the cases that were selected for the book included East Timor and Palestine and Somalia, Bosnia, Liberia, and Afghanistan. And so some of those cases had problems of, they were all interesting cases of statehood and state development. So some of them were very weak states. But obviously Palestine poses the question of a state that's not a juridical state. So one of the questions that is raised in these case studies is the relationship between external sovereignty or external statehood, recognition by the international community as a state, versus internal or domestic sovereignty, internal sovereignty, as Jackson first termed it some 15, 20 years ago. And so, 28 years ago, maybe. Anyway, but those questions and the relationship between them for people who were trying to build peace also came through in the case studies and also in the thematic treatments. And in our thematic treatments, you see, we had some case studies. That we had issues of security, post-war security, public finance, the rule of law, economic policy, and some others that you can see that I won't name. But I think that this book, we found, has only become, the questions raised in the book have only become more pertinent in the last year, I would say, since it was published last fall. And that is partly because I think the development community has really started to wrestle with these questions even more now. That's indicative of OECD DAC, looking at the Paris Declaration and the follow-up to the Paris Declaration that is really being pressed in the arena of development donors who are being pressed to channel resources through states, et cetera. And I think one of the things that at UNDP, for example, you see issues of statehood raised, and people are asking, you know, why and how and what sort of state are we talking about when we talk about state building. I think sort of we've entered a second generation of questions about this issue. I'm hopeful that we have at least. Let me just mention a few of the main findings that I talk about in the conclusion to the volume that I think are pertinent to raise here. One of them is that one of the main sort of thrusts of my findings and putting this volume together and working with these very talented authors is that there are actually some tensions between peace building and state building. And so the, even if we agree, as I agree at the in the volume, that actually having an effective and legitimate state is a very important thing for sustainable peace. So that's one of the things that we discussed and debated and is in the book. But the process of getting there is not necessarily, the process of state building itself is not necessarily good for peace always. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So one of the things that I start out talking about is do no harm state building. And I talk about three types of harm that can be done by state builders in post-conflict settings. And one of them is the harm of neglect, and that's the failure to act. And in there we talk about the example of Afghanistan, you know, the most obvious, sort of the absence of acting in a post-war setting. The most obvious example in Afghanistan was after the Soviet withdrawal and the failure to sort of continue and pay attention there. But even more relevant these days was the reluctance of international community to deploy troops outside of Kabul in the wake of the fall of the Taliban in 2001. And that really shaped the setting for post-conflict state building very importantly. There's some other examples there. The second type of harm is sort of is the opposite of neglect. It's excessive international presence and prerogatives. And this really derives from the mentality that both the reality of transitional administrations that we saw in Kosovo and East Timor, some of the issues that are raised in these cases are now quite evident to people in this field because they've seen in Iraq the problems of a very strong and the international actors taking over the state in essence and supplanting the state even for an interim period brings with it a number of challenges and problems even if some folks agree it's necessary at the time. And so the examples that we draw on there, East Timor provides an example of a relative success, but there were some problems with the way the international community engaged in East Timor, which Sarah, who was there at the time, in fact, has written on in other fora. But the assumption of a blank slate that a lot of international actors have when they go to a post-conflict setting is one of the problems that Sarah talks about in her chapter. And the assumption of full state authority, so you find that international actors spend a lot of time creating their own capacity and displacing state capacity in the process and delaying or ignoring the problems of working to create a sustainable, effective state on the ground. Related to that, not just sort of, there's also the possibility of what Krasner has called shared sovereignty, which is essentially the international community supplanting components of a state, perhaps for an indefinite time, perhaps for a limited time. And the Liberia case, many of you are probably aware of the Governance and Economic Management Assistance Program, GMAP it's called, where a coalition of international actors essentially took over public finance, particularly the revenues component of the Liberian state, And it's an interesting example, and our author who was involved in that debate raises some of the issues, some of the problems with that, as well as some of the advantages of it. A lot of these are some of the same dilemmas that development actors are now confronting in terms of assuming state functions being the expedient thing to do, but perhaps undermining sustainability, and the balance that is trying to be struck between expedience and sustainability in state building is sort of a crucial crux of the questions that we're looking at. I talked there about a third harm, a harm of blind interest, or really unintended side effects of international presence. This includes the international actors, of course, sucking up the capacity out of the state, and so the very presence of a big UN operation takes capacity out of the state, and so ironically defeats the ultimate goal, if you will, of creating a sustainable state. Other things like the presence of internationals creating markets for sex trafficking and other kinds of illegal activities, as well as just undermining, really altering the game of legitimacy and supplanting and detracting from the legitimacy of state actors by their presence and their power of making decisions. And so the Bosnia case study really shows this quite well. Our Bosnia author worked in the Office of High Rep and was actually quite critical, even in the short term, of some of the things that seemed to be necessary for the OHR to do in Bosnia in terms of actually reversing decisions made by the Bosnian state. But he was very critical of the overall trajectory of that in terms of the legitimacy of the Bosnian state that was trying to be created. So let me just close by talking about two of the qualifications about sort of, yes, if the state is important for peace building, then there are two qualifications to that I gave. The first one I already mentioned, and that is that the act of state, even if we can agree that states are good, the process of building them might be bad for peace. Okay? One of the best examples for this is perhaps the best example is Somalia, and I will simply defer to Ken to discuss this in his remarks about these tensions that were created by the international community's approach to building the state in Somalia in the early part of this decade. The second part of the second attitude is bypassing state institutions in order to, as we already discussed, can undermine legitimacy and capacity. A third element and a third approach of state building that might be not necessarily good for peace is the emphasis that some development actors have on meritocracy. And so you have a mindset in some cases of hiring people on the basis of qualifications and passing tests, and eschewing political criteria. And this is great for the long-term trajectory of capacity, perhaps, but it's not necessarily in terms of the legitimacy of those institutions if certain groups feel excluded from that, partly because certain groups might have differential capacities. So I use here, I think back on the example of the Salvadoran police, for example, after the war in El Salvador, where recruitment of former guerrillas had a quota, and they had qualifying tests, but the former guerrillas failed most of those tests. And so they ended up basically monkeying with the test scores and doing a lot of last-minute tutoring to get them over the hurdle, because if they were excluded from the police force, then that police force was not going to have very much legitimacy in good portions of the country. And so this tension between meritocracy and power sharing, if you will, or representation of groups, is one that exists within the context of state building in post-conflict societies. And finally, one of the tensions is that strengthening state capacity blindly without regard to the legitimacy of the state institutions that you're strengthening can, of course, strengthen corrupt or authoritarian authorities. And so Charles Taylor in Liberia is a very good example, where basically you have an election and you have a leader elected, and so you have an international strategy to strengthen the state. But if that, you can say that's a legitimate exercise because of the election, but in fact, the legitimacy of that state, based on the way it behaved and based on the way it incorporated enemies, ended up being quite self-defeating and leading to a recurrence of war in Liberia within a few years. And so it's how to manage strengthening capacity with illegitimate actors is, again, a crucial challenge for post-conflict state building, and one that that requires some really deft bureaucratic strategizing, and that broad policies and doctrines find difficult to confront. The last point I'm going to make is that, ironically, in many societies, basically we have to recognize that even if we would like to see strong and legitimate states, that authorities that are state-like authorities exist at many different levels, and in some cases are more effective or more legitimate than states. So you have sub-state actors. So when we talk about state building, in the conclusion, I talk about state building below the state and above the state and around the state. And so above the state, I'm referring to at the regional level. So you have regional organizations that can actually perform some of the functions or oversight functions of states that are actually quite pertinent today, and that when we think about developing state capacities, we should not ignore those. And they're not necessarily sort of. I think the state building mission should not be defined so narrowly. It has to be at the level of the national state. However, it's really important for those regional authorities and sub-state authorities, which I'll talk about here for a second, articulate with the state. And so what we find in many weak states is that you have sub-state authorities or regional authorities, and the states have no monitoring or monitoring functions of those. So we were just talking yesterday here at a meeting about the schools in Haiti, so that where 90% of the schools in Haiti are private. And so the state is not even regulating the structures of the buildings. And so when I was there last November, there was this big scandal about all these schools, private schools were collapsing, and the state had apparently no role of regulating those. So an example of that in terms of the private actors that are working, and Will Reno's chapter actually goes into some detail about legitimate tribal authorities at sub-state levels and the challenges of integrating them in ways, in the state-building enterprise, in ways that can bolster their sustainability. I'm going to stop there and turn it over to Sarah or to Dan.
Thank you, Chuck. Sarah.
Thanks. I think Chuck described very well some of the background to this book. I would say that it came about at a period where there was a general feeling, particularly in UN peacekeeping and peacebuilding circles, that there was a need to bring the state back in to some extent, that many of the peacekeeping operations of the 90s and the early 2000s had focused very strongly on the immediate political agreements, the security operation, and humanitarian activities, and then had got into a situation where it was very difficult for them to exit because they had not focused on trying to support the type of national institutions that would be able to take over and sustain a peace. So that generally was the background. I have to say that because the project took some time in coming together, I had to go back and reread the chapter that I'd written before coming here today to see how much I still agreed with the conclusions. I think I broadly do, but there is actually one or two areas that I would now emphasize more than I did at the time. One is about the politics of state building. I think Chuck also referred to that. And the other is about working very much between the cracks, between the state and its relationship with its population, different interest groups, with civil society more broadly. So I'll come back to those at the end. The chapter that I co-authored with my colleague Nick Manning focuses on four problems in previous operations by the international community to support states in post-conflict situations. The first is this problem of assuming a blank state and bringing in inappropriate models from outside. I heard over and over again in East Timor when I was first there that nothing existed in East Timor before the international community arrived to support the post-conflict peace. Now, East Timor, of course, was a country which had not had a national state before, so certainly it had not had the kind of peak-level institutions that after independence it had to establish. But of course it was a country in which institutions existed, because institutions exist everywhere. So the failure to look adequately at what sort of institutions were working well previous to the arrival of a massive peacekeeping operation, and even for those which were not working well and may have been the source of human rights abuses or corruption, look at whether there were positive elements which could be built on, I think has been one of the main failures of our support in this area. Combined often with bringing in very advanced and boilerplate models of how to run institutions, which were often not well adapted to the history of the countries concerned. Second area is the problem of prioritizing the functions of the state and the relationship between the state and society, which the international community focuses on supporting. And here I think we've seen a whole raft of international operations which have huge donor programs supporting everything from basic education to tertiary education, agricultural extension to infrastructure, building, health services to job creation. Not enough prioritization, and in countries with weak capacity, not only at the institutional level, but also in terms of political decision making, was asking too much, I think, of fragile counterparts in the leadership of those countries to try to take forward so many initiatives all at the same time. So we suggest in the chapter really taking a much harder look at which functions are necessary for the state institutions to survive and which are sufficient to preserve the credibility after a peace agreement of new state institutions. And I can give an example of that distinction actually using the current situation in Somalia. There is now a new government which has just returned to Mogadishu in the south of Somalia. There was a debate over what the new government should focus on and what support the international community should provide. And the initial debate focused very much on the need for the new government to pay the police and the security forces. That was the sole focus of the debate. Now that, I think, falls under being necessary for the survival of the state, in that certainly if they are not able to sustain under some sort of framework their security forces, they will not survive. But it's not very good in being sufficient for the credibility of the state, because in many cases the people who belong to these security forces are not well viewed by the population as their protectors and friends. They're often viewed as the source of previous abuses. So a new government which only pays these people and does nothing else is not likely to build up very much credibility and legitimacy more broadly. So that, I think, is an argument that you also need some basic functions which will help with the credibility of the state, such as very basic health services or something simple in terms of getting kids back to school or labour-intensive works. Also, within that question of prioritising functions, the chapter deals with the trade-off between capacity and legitimacy. That, particularly in terms of trying to provide new state institutions with credibility, there's a desire to make sure that they are implementing some of the international financing that comes into a country after conflict. But if that process, for example, goes too fast, you can end up, in fact, with an increase in corruption, very widely perceived by the population, which will be bad for their credibility rather than good for it. So there is a need, I think, to trade off always those two objectives. Third main area of problem that we point to is the use of transitional institutions, both national and international. International, Chuck already talked about. I think there is a widespread consensus now in the international community that the Timor and Kosovo transitional administrations were too broad in what they tried to do. They tried to do everything from running the security forces to running the traffic police and the extension services. At first, we weren't very good at it. The international community was actually not very good at being a government. And second, it supplanted areas where the Kosovars or the Timorese were actually capable of running some of those functions. And they, of course, resented that the international community was running them for them. We also look at the issue of transitional national institutions, governments of national unity, for example, during the transition, transitions in service delivery, where you may have humanitarian agencies running services for a period before handing over to government provision. And there too, I think there have been a lot of problems in these operations in the past. In terms of political transitional institutions, there has often been a gulf in communication between the internationals who facilitate political agreements, mediators in their teams, and the international counterparts who later deal with the government as a functioning entity, which has often meant that the agreements have created, for instance, proliferating ministries with very overlapping functions, because that was an easy way to get political buy-in at the time of signing a peace agreement, but that postponed a problem 6 months down the line where those ministers were unable to operate together and competed and undermined each other rather than actually working together. Last area which I won't dwell on is on the area that I think Chuck called unintended consequences, which we call collateral damage. The international community by its very presence often has consequences that are harmful to the building of national capacity. So we particularly point to high wages for staff in international agencies that draw people out of national institutions and uncoordinated technical assistance. Last area, we have a number of recommendations which I'll cluster into two areas, some on the politics of state building and some on the process. In terms of the politics of state building, I think nothing that we looked at here is really rocket science, but these are perhaps some areas where there are very obvious communication gaps in terms of how the processes of making political agreements link up with the processes of actually supporting through economic aid later on. One is the link between peace agreements and subsequent support. So the point I made, that the people who facilitate peace agreements often know very little about what it will mean to be a functioning government later on. Another, which is not in the chapter, but I have reflected on quite a bit previously, is our uncertainty in the international community about the shape of the state that we think is going to be supported. And I think that the best example of this is Afghanistan, where the tension between the idea of a deconcentrated state, where we were essentially trying to support Kabul to project its influence into the provinces, versus a decentralized state where we were supporting provincial authority, that tension was never resolved. As a result of which, many donors supported diplomatically the Kabul government, but channeled funding, some of it open, some of it less open, directly to provincial areas. And that really undermined the process of building institutions in Afghanistan. The last area we look at is more on the process area. So the need to do a rapid institutional assessment and a much better look at what capacities exist within countries when we have a turnaround in a situation, so we can really build on those capacities. And I think the area there that I've reflected on a little more since writing this is very much the need not only to look at the state governmental institutions, but to look at communities, civil society, a broader sense of what national institution building really means. So I'll stop there and hand over to Ken.
Thank you very much, and we'll talk to Ken Menkhouse, who's going to focus, I think, his remarks on Somalia.
I'm getting over a cold. Take this. I've reached that glorious point in my life when my eyesight is going, and the fact that I'm 6'5 means podiums really don't work for me. So if I hunch over now to read this with my $12 CVS goggles here, forgive me. The question that I was asked we are asked to consider in the volume is a good one. Under what circumstances does state building work against rather than with peace building? And when one looks at the case study of Somalia, the answer is most of the time. We have not had much luck there. There is some good news coming out of Somalia in recent months, but this has certainly been a case study that mainly informs our understanding of what doesn't work. And what we've seen in Somalia, though, when you broaden your horizons and look at other case studies, you see that, in fact, it does form very much a part of the template that my colleagues have already been talking about. And I want to speak just a moment about that template. peace building and state building in these post-conflict settings tends to be melded by a strategy that focuses on power sharing. And power sharing, at least temporarily, as a function of transitional governments. And this is key. This is what binds them. State building is thus seen as critical for what? First, for building the legitimacy of a transitional government, providing some basic services. Second, providing some basic security and order. Third, state building is important to peace building in that it provides positions and money for patronage that facilitates negotiations, keeps spoilers in the game by expanding the pie that they're interested in, that is known as the state. And to back up and just generalize, basically make state building or use state building to make peace building a positive sum game. Everyone walks away a winner because we're expanding the cake. You get the ministry of this, you get the ministry of that. We had at one point in one of the many iterations of a Somali transitional government, this was in 2005, we had over 80 ministers, including, of course, a minister of tourism for Somalia, all informed by this logic, though, of using the state to provide as many opportunities as possible to keep as many warlords happy as you could. And then, again, to be generous with this strategy, it's also seen as, I mean, the whole point of power sharing in a transitional government is also to begin a process of trust building, routinizing cooperation among people who have not only not been speaking to each other, but have been shooting at each other for years or even decades. The problem here, of course, is that peace building often gets lost in this, and it's reduced to power sharing in state building projects. And the problem in Somalia specifically is that none of this really worked well. First, it ends up that we don't have power sharing arrangements. Typically, these transitional governments have turned out to be a victor's peace, a zero-sum game in which one side manages to cobble together a coalition at someone else's expense. And that then raises the very troubling question of when the international community comes in, thinking it is a unity government and a transitional government, and we're going to build their capacity, the question arises, capacity to do what? And in the case of Somalia, too often it's been the capacity to use security forces that we've paid directly, bags of money from donors through UNDP, plunk to the chief of police, who was a warlord, and they use the police then to terrorize the population. And this is a huge problem. We have had capacity building as part of this, a perfectly reasonable quest to build the capacity of a state that's been gone for 20 years, but because we didn't twin it with accountability measures, making sure that the police actually were acting through rule of law and that we knew what they were doing. And even when we knew what we were doing, we had the political will, the backbone, to say stop it. And of course we didn't at the time because we were very much invested at that point in the success of the government and saw the insurgents that they were terrorizing as terrorists until then we decided that they'd make a good president, which we've done in the past few months. A lot of this, again, to look back at some of the broader frameworks that we use in development, was the tension between democratization versus a fragile states approach. What are we trying to do with these states? Are we trying to build their accountability based on and limit the what the state can do based on the premise that these states, in order to be legitimate, have to actually abide by rule of law? Or is it the fragile states approach where the problem is essentially the state is too weak, not too unaccountable? And I don't think in Somalia we ever really reconciled the two, and I'm not even sure we really thought about it enough. The other logic that we saw in Somalia with capacity building for the state was an urgent plea, again, mainly from the Somalis, but this, you could hear this in the dialogue among the donors, that we need to get more money in there for patronage, that we've got to support the co-optation of some of the opposition by bringing them in. There's nothing necessarily wrong with this, but in order to bring in enough people, enough of the spoilers, to make the center hold in Somalia, you needed a massive amount of money.
And the amount of money, it wasn't available, or when it was, it came in one-off short injections, and then it was immediately eaten up. And this raised the question, though, of sustainability. Now, I know sustainability for a lot of people, they roll their eyes and say that under the current circumstances, sustainability isn't what's important. What's important is we've got to get this state back on its feet. But the fact is that with a government that is relying for almost 100% of its budget on foreigners, you're building states that can't be sustained with local revenues. You're setting them up for failure because this is capricious money. It may or may not be there a couple years from now. But I think the bigger problem is this. Even if you had a trust fund that just guaranteed a Somali government $200 million a year, which they would think is not very much, right? It's $500 million a year, there's no accountability because no one's paying taxes. There's no sense of ownership of the state. And this has been the problem from the get-go in Somalia, is no one has ever held governments accountable because they're almost always entirely funded from outside. Some other tensions that this situation produced, and this here we're getting into organizational politics in the UN, but I think it's important to be frank with this. There were enormous tensions between different branches of the UN and the donor community over different objectives. On the one hand, you had the diplomats, including the UN Department of Political Affairs, that was pushing very hard to get all of the aid actors, both the development actors and the humanitarian actors, to work through the state, to build the state capacity, to legitimate the state. This is how people are going to see that the state is valuable. You work through them. You had UNDP, which initially grabbed this mandate where the governance people, of course, will do this. You know, they took it on. And then they ran into the problem that we often face in these settings, and that is they were now the main conduit for development assistance, capacity building, good governance, security sector reform to a government that was a party to an ongoing conflict. Mm-hmm. Post-conflict, of course, is in many ways a misleading term. A lot of times these are conflicts that are not entirely resolved. There is backsliding, and certainly it was the case in Somalia that this was a government that was very much a party to a dispute. UNDP, by first embracing and then later being forced to serve as the partner for the international donor community channeling aid to the transitional federal government, thereby lost any semblance of neutrality in Somalia. It was seen as aiding and abetting the transitional federal government by the opposition, and guess what happened? UNDP started getting targeted, and all the other UN agencies did as well, because the insurgents weren't really all that interested in the distinctions within the UN family. They saw it as all one big clan and not 16 quarreling clans. We all know that the clan warfare in the UN is a lot more serious. But the fact is, what we ended up with then is these organizations being attacked, people losing their lives. The chief national officer of UNDP being assassinated in Mogadishu in late October. UNDP's compound was hit by a suicide bomber up in Somaliland. And then we get the opposite extreme, where the UNDP swings back now for security reasons and says, we're suspending operations in Somalia, it's not safe. And it raises a very interesting question for these kinds of settings. If we're going to do capacity building and security sector reform and pay the police, for governments that are emerging from conflict, that are still fighting somebody, because there are almost always someone who's a spoiler on this, what do we do about the security of those organizations that have taken sides? And the answer now from UNDP is we're not really interested in doing this anymore. They've gotten hurt really bad in Baghdad and Mogadishu and some other places. And the next iteration of this in Somalia, it's going to be a very interesting question to see which organization is actually willing to engage in that state building. Meanwhile, you had other tensions. Am I running out of time?
Being pretty interesting, too.
All right. I thought at first I was going to talk for 3 minutes and lose my voice. Meanwhile, you had the humanitarian, and this is just to capture how difficult all this is on the ground. You've got the UN Department of Political Affairs pushing hard for everyone to work through the government. Now you've got the humanitarian agency saying, absolutely not, we need to work around the government, because this is the only way we're going to maintain our neutrality. So you've got WFP, World Food Program, making deals now, even as we speak, with some of the hardline Islamist groups, the Shabab, which is, according to the U.S., it's designated a terrorist group, in order to get food from point A to point B to people in need. They're taking a do-whatever-it-takes approach, work with whoever you find on the ground, whether they're palatable or not palatable, in order to get the food on the ground. So everyone is essentially working at cross purposes in all of this. And then if you throw the U.S. counterterrorism in Afghanistan is a great example of this, where you say you're building the state, but you're actually working around the state with non-state partners in pursuit of bad guys. Your partners soon develop a keen interest in maintaining the status quo, because state building would actually reduce their value to a very a lucrative external partner. Okay. Why do we keep insisting that Somali remake itself politically in our own image? Here, just for a couple of minutes, I'd like to talk about an alternative model, an alternative approach to Somalia that those of us who've been working on this, for lack of a better term, call a mediated state. It's actually a term borrowed from historians. And this is both an explanation and a potential prescription. As an explanation, the way this goes is, if you look hard at weak states, fragile states around the world, and even some pretty robust states, they have limits on their capacity, limits on their ability to extend their sovereignty, either geographically into border areas or just, you know, into society. And what they often end up doing is negotiating and ceding authority to local non-state actors, whoever they find on the ground. Sometimes this works very nicely. In the case of northern Kenya, the Kenyan government has not been able to project its sovereign authority into some of the northern district areas, the semi-arid border zones. It's working with Somali, a hybrid group of Somalis, women's market groups and clan elders and clerics and professional groups who have essentially come to run the day-to-day affairs of an entire district, and in the process have made an area that was one of the most dangerous and insecure in Kenya 10 years ago into one of the safest today. And the Kenyan government has actually decided to use that as a model in some of its other border areas with some success. Sometimes this is bad. Northern Pakistan, Wajiristan, the tribal areas, this doesn't work very well at all. I would say this is not even unique to fragile states. You can find numerous cases here in the United States of police forces that essentially work out deals with criminal gangs or gangs in tough urban slums, where they establish some basic rules of the game over what can and can't be done in their particular territory. All that to say is that this is an explanation of what's actually happening on the ground. We have authority. It's a hybrid, messy mixture of polities, of systems of governance out there apart from the state. And the state can either ignore it, try to supplant it, or it can partner with it. And what we see in many places is that they do try to partner with it. This is, from a realist point of view, this is working with what's already happening on the ground. It's not utopian at all. Financially, what's attractive about this is it's also very realistic. These are states that are going to have very small budgets. They can't be expansive. There's no way they can take on all of this, all of these responsibilities. And so at least as a transitional strategy, plugging into existing authorities, letting local communities, whatever is working reasonably effective, letting them continue to do that until such time as they've got enough money and they can then decide whether they want to continue doing it or be a Scandinavian welfare state, that's fine. But, you know, for Somalia, for instance, we're talking about a country that's probably going to try to govern a territory that stretches from southern Maine to northern Florida on $100 million a year, if they're lucky. And so the minimalist state, this mediated state, really isn't so much an ideological choice of a libertarian. I mean, I'm married to a Swede, I can't be, as it is just a political reality. Is this a perfect solution? Absolutely not. There are enormous problems with dealing with non-state actors as governance partners. It's illiberal, particularly when it involves either Sharia law or customary law. It's patchy. It's extra constitutional. There's a variety of reasons why it's not always appropriate, and I think my conclusion has been that's why governments at the local level and their external friends need to make judgments on a case-by-case basis as to whether this is an appropriate transitional strategy for state building. Why in the end? Because This is what I like the most about it, is this is a human security approach to the question of state building. It's not asking what can we do to make the state's capacity stronger, it's what can we do to make local communities that have lived through hell for 5, 10, 30 years in these places more secure. And when you ask the question that way, suddenly this approach looks a lot more attractive.
Thank you very much, Ken. Karen?
Thanks for inviting me to join you all today. It's hard to follow on these three speakers. They're all really outstanding analysts, and they have a lot of great field experience. And this book is really super, so I'd recommend it for everyone here, although it may not be so easy to find. What I wanted to do was, rather than be a critic of the book, is actually reinforce some of the main points, because I happen to agree with what they were all saying. I thought I would make focus on four challenges that will just really reinforce what they were all saying, based also on my own experience. And the first really follows perfectly on what Ken was just saying, and what Sarah was also saying about the shape of the state. I don't think when we get into these situations we focus on what the end state will be. We're usually in too much of a rush, and so we don't really ask what are the minimal functions that the state should provide. Instead, the state, as Ken was saying, becomes something that people fight over. And what we really want to achieve is something like Switzerland, where I wonder if anyone here in this room besides Chantal can name one famous Swiss politician or the president today. You want a situation where you don't care about the personalities, where it's the institutions that are quite strong. Now, I was involved in the mid to late 90s in Somalia in a project where we pulled together Somali civil society leaders, and we said, you know, what are the basic things that a state needs to provide? What are the minimal things that a state should provide? Well, maybe, you know, an army, but not every state has an army. A currency, but, you know, actually they use a dollar right now today. Maybe foreign relations with other states, but we have examples in other parts of the world where parts of states actually do that instead. So to keep the state so weak that there's really nothing to fight for is what our challenge should be. And I don't think we really focus on that enough when we get into these situations. You know, it was interesting in Somalia when we would describe, you know, very decentralized options. And we'd say, well, what kind of state do you want? And they'd say, well, we want a federal state. And then what they would describe was really a confederal situation, like the European Union. And we'd say, well, that's actually a confederation. And they say, no, because that sounded too scary. They don't want the state to break up. They want, on paper, a federation, but really in practice, it was a confederation. It's very similar to what you find in Afghanistan today. Federation actually is a dirty word in Afghanistan, but it is, you know, it's a very decentralized situation after years and decades of civil war. So that's sort of the first point, is really to probe those issues much more deeply from the beginning, rather than who's Minister of Finance, who's President, and who's Vice President. The second area is, you know, just to reemphasize what Sarah was saying, we rely on a bunch of old tools that aren't that good. So, you know, peacekeeping works in some places. It hasn't been an overall success everywhere, as Charles has done some great work on in the past. And yet we're talking about a peacekeeping force in Somalia. We know it didn't work the first time. We also saw in 2006 that when the Islamic Court Union took over, that there was security in Somalia. So we know Somalis are capable of providing for their own security. We know that when we come in heavily, like we have done in the past, we give them something else to fight for. We also know that Somalis send about $1 billion a year from the diaspora into the country. They invest in schools and factories. At the moment, a lot of that's been destroyed because of, partially due to our involvement in the last few years, of the fighting. But, you know, there's a Coca-Cola factory that was launched in, 2004, 2005, although I think it's shut
still
down.
There.
No, it's still there. So, you know, if you look at what works, and then you really focus on supporting what works, as Sarah was saying. We hear in many places, you know, if you look at Afghanistan, people say, there's no capacity, we can't spend the money, there's no capacity. Well, the capacity is certainly weakened because of decades of civil war, because 20% of the population may be literate. But actually, there is a lot of capacity. There's a lot of resilience, and we just don't understand it very well. And we're always in a rush, and so we're not spending the time that we should to understand it and to build on that. So that's sort of my second point. We really want to facilitate. We want to catalyze. We don't want to supplant, as Charles was saying. We don't need these big contractors coming in. We don't need a bunch of internationals coming in that require a whole bunch of security and cost a lot of money. The third area that I wanted to mention, I'm going to try to stay to 5 minutes, is really to build on what Will Reno was talking about in his chapter, and some of the panelists mentioned, which is you often have sub-state structures that are in competition with the state. In weak states, they can be quite strong, and we've seen in a number of cases that many extremist charities end up providing state services. So the Hamas model, the Hezbollah model, in Pakistan and Kashmir, the Jamaat-ud-Dawah, which is affiliated to Lashkar-e-Taiba, these groups provide services and security to their population. They're competing with the state, and the state is too weak in many places to provide security. Now, given that we can't probably do that for the state for the long term, given that many of these states themselves are too weak to provide services for their own populations in the short, medium, and maybe the long term, I think we need to be far more creative than we have been about how we want to meet this type of challenge. And really, so that these sub-state groups don't take over completely in many of these states. The fourth area that I wanted to mention, and it is also another, in many senses, it's a reiteration of what the others have been saying, but really to be thinking less about political expediency versus getting it right. Now, I think one of the lessons that we learned in Iraq, and I'm not so sure it was a great lesson, is you build up the local security forces, that's your exit strategy. Now that's what we're doing in Afghanistan. We're trying to build the Afghan National Army, the Afghan police. When I was in Afghanistan a few months ago, you know, I heard from everybody, well, the army is really well respected here, and we're trying to build it up. And you know, the reality is the army's been there for 7 years. It's not this, you know, institution that's been around for decades that you know, is that you can be sure will maintain the role that it's maintaining. So I said, well, what are you trying to do, or what kind of mechanisms are you putting in to prevent a coup? That, in other words, are we just training for the next coup? And some people said to me, we haven't really thought about that very much, and other people said to me, we don't care. We're happy with a strong state. So, you know, then what's going to happen is, in the long term, what are we doing? Are we building a dictatorship, or are we building an authoritarian state? I don't think we think about this. Now, and today in Afghanistan, we're also getting involved in army local militias. And, you know, this is controversial. We spend a lot of time disarming at the local level. Do we want to do this? Can we control it? Can the Afghan government control it over the long term? If you think about when we intervened in Afghanistan in the first place, when we went in late 2001, we paired up with a bunch of warlords, creating problems because many of them are now in government, many of them are ministers, and many of them are governors and provinces. So the longer term and the shorter term, we're competing. And so those are really the four areas that I wanted to raise. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Karen. I'm going to open the floor to questions and comments. There are two microphones. I would ask people to line up at the microphones because it makes the process more orderly. I think it also helps our recording of the event. In while they're doing that, and Sloan will excuse me for telling a story, but a lot of stories came to my mind while you were all talking, but I'll tell only one, which is a few years after the war in Bosnia, the first time I'd been back after peace, I went to see a vice president who shared the generalized gloom that pervaded Bosnia in the late 90s, and I said to him, what's wrong around here? Everybody's so gloomy. The war is over. No more firing. I can walk down the street. It's what's the problem? And he said, you know, the real problem is that you've got 10,000 internationals here needing to report progress every week. And that has just distorted everything. That is, it's a story that occurred to me because of the more intellectually respectable formulations that you've put forward. That, you know, international intervention to build a state is a contradiction in terms. We all, I think, should know and appreciate that. But with that skeptical remark, I'll ask Sloan Mann to take the floor.
I think, unfortunately, I think my remark may be a bit skeptical.
So I'm saying where you're from.
Thanks. I'm with a company called Development Transformations. So listening to the panel was very informative. Thank you. It raised all kinds of questions in my head. Namely, you know, comes down to it,
we're probably just not really that good at state building. We have a lot to learn and a long way to go. But my question, Ken, is for you, and the panel, please feel free to comment. If there's any other Pakistani experts, this may be applicable as well. What role does Islam have as a potential inhibitor to state building? When you have a sizable portion of the population who may actually, in fact, believe that a secular state, whether it's weak or strong or centralized or decentralized, is haram, then how do you deal with that? And how much thought how do you take that into account in designing state building enterprises?
Ken, would you like to take that on?
Yes. In the case of Somalia, Islam has actually been one of the forces for state building. The Islamic Courts Union, when they came to power for 6 months, there's a lot of myth about this as well. A lot of what they did was not so much build a state structure. That what they did is they built an umbrella over a series of existing local clan-based Sharia courts that were doing quite a good job at the local level in this messy informal governance that I was describing. They hijacked it in some ways, but they did it in a very effective way, and we'll never know if that experiment had been allowed to continue, whether that would have culminated in a state, but it certainly did look like it. So from an ideological point of view, Islam was certainly a positive force. It was a unifying factor in a country that was very divided. It promised a sense of justice. It had the tradition of Sharia law on which it could base governance. And I think Somalis today, almost across the spectrum, see some form of political Islam as the future for whatever state they form.
Anybody else want to comment on that? Please.
Yes, my name is Luis Perafa, and I came from Spain. I want to pose a question to Karim Bonhippo. I saw in your biography that you work in Kosovo, and now the question, the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice about international legality of the independence of Kosovo, and if the International Court of Justice is a good means to try to solve the problem. No? Thank you.
Karen?
Yeah, I mean, in general, I believe in international institutions and appealing to international institutions for legitimacy. So I think that probably Kosovo could have been independent earlier on, but everyone was very nervous about creating new states, which was more of the issue than anything else, after the NATO intervention. I haven't really read enough into I'm sure you're much more up to date on that issue than I am, actually, but generally I'm, you know, support the International Criminal Court as well as the ICJ.
I think we'll all have to wait the decision to be able to comment on it. It's not surprising that declarations of independence are regarded as illegal. Certainly ours was, for example.
For countries that have sent ambassadors to Kosovo, to Pristina.
Yeah, I was going to comment on that as well. I have some experience in Kosovo, too. Anyone who thinks that the World Court is going to tell the United States that it can't send an ambassador to any country it wants to recognize has an interpretation of the powers of the World Court that exceeds mine. I just don't think that can happen. Please.
Hi, my name is Faribos Frank Fuladi. I'm from Procurement USA Inc. And we have a website, procurementusa.info. About state building, I was wondering, what's your opinion about state building in a micro level, like what we do in Montgomery County, Maryland? We make sure every citizen is taken care of when it comes to food, shelter, healthcare, and education, and then leave the policies and the politics to the big guys in the federal government. We start building the societies from micro level, from county level. What is your opinion on that? I'd like to hear from Mr. Kenneth and also Mr. Charles.
You want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first.
I think it's an interesting question, and I think it reflects some debates, particularly in the development community, about community-based development has not just
a way to do development, but also a way to actually build sustainable polities. And I think that one of the problems that I've seen as I look at many of my colleagues work in this area as well at American University, one of the things that I've seen, the challenges of that, is how that articulates with politics at the national level. Because I think it's very possible to create experiments at the local level that can be sustainable for a time. But, and I think of Colombia here, right? I mean, there are peace initiatives at the local level in Colombia that they can bear fruit and have some scope, but they can also be aplastado, completely decimated by armed groups at the national level or the regional level. And so without having some strategizing at the national level and about how there's an articulation between what happens at the local level and the national level, the sustainability of these experiments is actually quite tenuous, I think. And so I think that and then you have to think about the legitimacy, sort of the interplay and interaction of the legitimacy at the national level with that at the local level as well of these experiments. And Will Reno discusses some of this in his chapter in the book. But that's what I would have to say about that. I don't see that as sort of the, you know, bottom-up community-led state building. That's the way to go. But at the same time, I think that development agency, we need to think about that level, and particularly as we think about delivering services as well as providing oversight to state behavior.
Please.
Thank you. Omar Ismail with the ENOP Project. The peace agreements are normally seen as a tool to put together the state or to patch it up somehow. And then, like in the case of my country, Sudan, we had the comprehensive peace agreement, and we extended the pie. We brought in other people, and we have a semi-autonomous government in the south now. However, we introduced also self-determination as part of that peace agreement, which was supposed to serve as kind of a warning to the north to make unity attractive for the people of the south. However, it served, as far as I can see today, as an incentive to somebody in the south to do away with that state and to create their own state. I would like to hear from you how that will fit in state building or unraveling of states.
Sarah,
Just I have another comment, and this particular one too, Ken. I was fascinated by the mediations since we started working on this a long time ago. And in the case of Chad, for example, by the way, it's another country with a tourism minister. would that work with the proxy wars that we see? And Sudan having GEM being, you know, using the justice and equality movement in the case of Darfur, and this proxy wars between the two governments, would that be a formula? So the government of Sudan will change its alliance from the Janjaweed, for example, to the Darfur and rebel groups, and then we will see a mediated state there, or in the case of Chad, with the rebels in the east. Could that formula work? Thank you,
Sarah. I think you wanted to respond first.
Just on the first part of that question, I always thought that the CPA interim period was exactly wrong in terms of being neither short enough nor long enough. So neither short enough to move rapidly to some clarity on direction, nor long enough to actually really give a generational chance to some sort of different outcome there. The one thing about it, though, is that it should have actually created some incentives in terms of accountability and service delivery in the state, which I think in practice didn't happen. And it's an interesting question why they didn't happen. It should have created those incentives because it was clear that with the timing of the referendum, if the government in the south, the SPLM could not create a perception that they were delivering services, that they were fair in terms of, or reasonably inclusive in terms of appointments and how the formation of the state was going, and that they were avoiding corruption, then they would be vulnerable later down the line. Now, in fact, I think those incentives didn't quite work out as strongly as we would have wanted to see them. So it's an interesting question.
I think it's fair to say that the death of John Durango also had something to do with the changed perception of the agreement. Ken, did you want to?
If I could just add, I mean, the short answer on Chad and Darfur is I don't know. I think it's a possibility. But the bigger question that's raised by the cases that you're flagging, when we look at the Horn of Africa writ large, when you're on the ground in any one of these countries, you can't help but be struck at how irrelevant our conception of the state is to the political realities. And it's both the fact that the state is not providing any of the core functions we associate with a state in these areas, that the state in this is the only part of Africa where the state is being its borders are being actively challenged. I mean, we have Eritrea broken off. We've got government of South Sudan that if it gets a chance to hold a referendum will break away. You've got Somaliland that's been unrecognized but functioning now for 18 years. And this could go on. I mean, we're not necessarily done. It does raise the question of, you know, are we looking through the right lens in understanding governance and authority in these areas? And you know, the pessimistic side of me sees this as things fall apart. The optimistic part of me says, no, in fact, what we might be seeing is this is the part of Africa that's really shaking off an old colonial, post-colonial political order that was foisted on it, and it's remaking politics in a way that's more organic, more appropriate, and we have no idea what's going to emerge from this. We presume it will be state-like in some way, but it might not, in fact, be recognizable to us, and that's okay. It's our problem to try to learn how to deal with them rather than insisting that they, again, remake themselves in our image.
Chuck?
I'm kind of prejudiced against lawyers, and lawyers tend to think about statehood and sovereignty very much in juridical terms of independence or not, and I've come around to seeing the logic of that more in the last few years. And the questions you raise basically point to how important the interaction between this external sovereignty and internal sovereignty is, and that thinking about that relationship is really important. And the point that I want to make really broadly is one that Ken has just sort of given some example of, but the broader point for me is I just wanted to remind us that we live in a time where we're still, the sort of a normative environment at the international level to go into the sort of constructivist kind of theoretical world for a minute, where borders are not changed easily in today's day and age. And it's very easy, I think, for us to imagine, or it's difficult for us to imagine, but I think we should think about a different kind of environment 10 or 20 years down the road where many borders have changed and the international community is more comfortable with changing borders than it used to be. And this region that you're discussing might be one of the areas. Obviously, we've seen some border change in the Balkans in the last few years. But I think it's very conceivable that in 50 or 60 years, we'll see many dozens of new states on the map of the world. And I think that normative environment is very important. And the second point I would make about that is two things. One is that I don't think that people are thinking about that in a very realistic, in any serious way right now. And the second is to go back to this point that Karen made, which is I don't think that international actors are thinking about how to, I mean, it's just crazy. If as Ken says, states are irrelevant to the political realities on the ground, why do all these actors care so much about them? And to make them less important, as Karen says, is something that I also don't think we're thinking enough about either. And that goes back to this regionally super-state and sub-state authorities that actually can be creatively enhanced by international action in some of the ways that Ken actually has many examples that he can talk about more than he mentioned here. So I'll stop.
Maybe I can be permitted a slight comment in my way of thinking. What we've done is not so much to move borders in recent years as to change the status of some internal boundaries to international borders. I don't know many cases where we've actually moved borders. Please.
I think you're missing a chapter in your book, and I think the title would be not should the international community do post-conflict, but can it do this task? And
remind us who you are.
I'm a consultant here in Washington.
Give us your name.
Peter Morgan.
Think.
And many of the things you've said about donors doing the wrong things, all of them are true, and all of them are true for the usual reasons. Too much reporting, not using the state, not enough time, inappropriate models, too much TA. All of these have been around for decades. None of this is new. And clearly these patterns are locked in place, which encourage in some ways donors to do the wrong things, even when they know they're not the right things. And it's not because people are stupid, but it's because donors themselves have pressures and situations and incentives and all the rest of them, which are not intellectually easy to get around logistically. My question is, what is it that has to happen here? What is it that must be done to build the capabilities of donors to do this kind of complex work? And is that approach to donor capacity building feasible in the present context?
I imagine, Karen, you want to say something about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a super question and something I think all of us wrestle with a lot. So that's why, you know, in a sense, the question of this panel is, you know, is different than will we continue to do it? The likelihood is we'll continue to do it, and we're not doing a very good job. And you're right, we haven't done a good job. When we go in waves, we get really intense, and then we pull back. And, you know, Somalia in 1993 caused a retrenchment until basically 9/11, and now we're, you know, going in big time again. I think one of the things that's quite interesting, though, due to globalization, is the unleashing of so many things because of technology, you know, cell phones and the internet, and there's so many ways that local communities act and build on the ground that really have very little to do with us. And so in some senses, we may be becoming more relevant, but we really need to be much more creative how we harness these new tools, social networking, Web 2.0, user-driven innovation models. And if we can do that in a more substantial way, I think then we can actually have the leverage factor that we all want to have in these places.
Sarah?
Yeah, I'm maybe a little bit more optimistic, but not much. I think there are two types of changes that are needed. One is on donors' own capacities, and I'd say most donors are about halfway through making the type of change that is actually needed there. The types of change are being able to get the right people on the ground quickly and keep them there. So donors used to try and do this sort of work long distance. It clearly doesn't work long distance. You have to have the right people on the ground quickly. Having quick funding release mechanisms that can finance much more quickly than we used to be able to do. Having funding mechanisms that are more flexible in terms of the grey areas between humanitarian and development aid, or for issues like ODA eligibility of security sector expenses, that type of thing. So so in those terms, the bank I know has gone through a lot of changes over the past 5 or 6 years in this way. I would say we're still half to two-thirds through those changes. Most other donors are in the process of trying to do the same thing. But no matter, even when we finish that process, and even say we get to a stage where we actually are a little bit more confident over our capacities, I still think that our expectations have to be very modest. Mm-hmm. These are not problems that will be solved by fantastic international capacity. They're problems that will be solved by a more thoughtful approach to drawing on local capacities to solve.
Nevertheless, I feel driven to mention that it's my understanding that in the budget that passed the U.S. Senate yesterday, I think, that there is a very substantial amount of money for the State Department to enhance its capacity to send people abroad into conflict situations. And I add on as well that USIP is enhancing its own capacity to provide training to such people with 17 courses that are now being piloted. Those who are interested can find them on our website.
Can I just add something on this?
Please, Chuck.
I do want to address your question about CAN, but first I just want to say something about should the international community do this. I didn't really give a definitive answer to this, and I just wanted to, obviously you get a sense that we think that it should be done in some positive way, better way. I think that that's my answer at least. But I think there is this, I just want to call attention to this critique out there that is important about, you know, sort of the imperial pretensions of Western agendas in weak states, and the state building agenda being used to essentially, you know, to exercise power in poor countries. And Barney Rubin, in his chapter on security in the book, talks about sort of the legitimacy of international actors is also important and needs to be looked at separate from the legitimacy of national actors. And then they're interrelated, right? But one of the implications of that is that
other actors, donors, particularly Western countries, need to think about working with other actors, regional organizations, others that have legitimacy that basically can blunt this critique, if you will, and also actually provide different substance into thinking about what sort of state is being built in any given context. And that means consultations, you know, with local civil society, but also with regional actors. And I think that that's an important sort of element of these, should the international community do this. In terms of can it do this, I just want to talk, I think there's a debate about, there's right now, I was just going to draw attention to this fact that right now there's, the U.S. is really gearing up to increase its capacity for international, for its own institutions to do this sort of thing. And I think that there are two ways of thinking about this, and one of them is, U.S. bilaterals really gear up their capacity, the U.N. as well, to go and deploy people to do this sort of thing, the civilian side of state building and occupation, if you will. And there's another critique, which is no, that we don't need a lot of numbers of internationals doing this. What we need are smart power, if you will, or smart state building, which doesn't require a lot of people or a light footprint, in the words of Lakhdar Brahimi. But really, the only people who are going to be able to do this sustainably are locals, if you will. And what you need are people who are practiced in the ways of working with locals and figuring out the politics of the situations and understanding the relationships between development dynamics and humanitarian dynamics and security dynamics and the politics of working with local actors in these. And I associate myself very much with that approach. And so I just wanted to sort of put those two approaches out there, because I think we're going to see a very big debate on this in the next 5 or 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Please.
My name is Raina Neufeld, and I work in American University. And I think Chuck just answered my question, actually, which was going to be to ask them. I noticed on the title, it's a very nebulous international community. And so who is it that the international community is that you're defining here? And then how do you define them, and how do we look at that accountability in terms of the actors that might be involved?
Please.
Yeah, I actually want to, that's a great point, because it isn't just the UN and the World Bank. Now we have Saudi, we have China, we have countries that may play by very different rules, and I'm not so sure we can impose our own standards and conditionality factors on these new players as well. Just one quick little point to back up what Charles was saying, really to follow on this previous question. I wrote a book that came out in 2000 called Democracy by Force, and then here we were in Kosovo, and we were building all these institutions, and a friend of mine said, your next book should be called Bureaucracy by Force. You know, I mean, I am very concerned about us building these big bureaucratic structures that may not fit, that aren't necessarily appropriate, sending too many people from the State Department, from DOD, to do a lot of this work.
Please, Ken.
I'm sorry, I have to go to catch a flight, or I'm not storming out because of something Karin just said.
Ken, thank you very much. We're going to wrap up in a minute in any case. Please.
Hi, my name is Joseph Pierce. Ms. Von Heppel and Mr. Call are actually touching on what I wanted to ask. I attended a morning conference today about DOD's business transformation, how they're getting more and more involved into state building, humanitarian assistance, PRTs in Afghanistan and Iraq. And maybe for those especially who have field experience in Iraq or some insights on Iraq or Afghanistan, what are your opinions on, you know, the DOD finding themselves usually in these situations first, with the most resources and the ability to go to kind of more dangerous areas?
It's 5:20 in the afternoon, and you open Pandora's box. I think we'll have to end here, Mary. I'm sorry. We'll have, because this is going to take a couple of minutes to answer this question, I'm quite certain. Why don't I go back through the panel, and in addition to answering this question, I beg you to say anything else that you would like to say. Karin, we'll start with
okay.
you.
Okay, yeah, Joey, that's a great question. You know, my concern in all of these places, when we have a big military footprint, the lesson, and this sounds sort of rhetorical, but the lesson of the exercise is to build democracy. Well, a fundamental tenet of democracy is having civilian oversight of the military. So what kind of example are we setting when our military is actually leading the political part of the process? And that's, you know, a concern that I've had the whole time. DOD is playing more and more in this space. They don't necessarily want to do it, but they've got much more capacity than anybody else does. So they're getting involved in development. We, you know, Special Forces are doing this now. You have all sorts of parts of the combatant commands that are trying to figure out what their role is. And so they're taking on more and more space in an area that's very concerning. You have AFRICOM being set up. You know, what are they going to be doing? It's, you know, those questions haven't really been debated publicly as much as they should.
Let me try Sarah next, and then you, Chuck.
Yeah, on this question, maybe just to reflect briefly on the PRTs and state building, which was not a question explicitly raised, but obviously has been a big focus of debate. I actually do worry quite a bit about this in everything except the most extreme situations. And accepting the fact that there are PRTs of very different models, so different nations have operated them in very different ways. Some have civilian leadership, some have military leadership. There are different models of doing it. But in general, I think the very central role for the military in civilian administration at local levels is something that in a state-building context is a very difficult example to be setting. Because when you're working with security sectors of the countries concerned to try and talk to them about the division of roles and about what a national army does not do, if you're out there setting exactly the contrary example to what you're debating with them in your SSR discussions, that's a difficult dialogue to hold. Just on the previous question about the international actors, I think we have to involve these actors in these discussions. It's simply untenable not to. And in terms of our concerns about where they're coming from, I think we can over-exaggerate this. I hear, for instance, very often that China's interest in Africa is political. Now, please, if we're saying that the UK or France's interest in Africa was not political historically, that's an odd statement to be making. So all bilaterals have political interests, including the newer actors, and you always have to mediate those interests. I also think that the newer regional actors, such as China, are increasingly learning some of the same lessons that those who have previously been the elephant in the room have learned, which is that if your programs are very large and you become the target of a lot of criticism, for example, for corruption in the countries concerned, this can be a very uncomfortable position to be in. And so they themselves are starting to feel that pressure and to feel that there is a need for them to take some action on it. Last, I really agree with what I think Chuck said on the regional organisations, that I think there are many situations where having a very variable constellation of actors around the table is critical, and the regional organisations often have a very important part to play.
Chuck?
I think that most people would agree that it's not optimal for military organizations to be doing these sorts of civilian tasks of state building. Most military officers, I think, agree with that as well. I think that the military has gotten involved because it had to, quote unquote, in some of these cases, certainly Afghanistan and Iraq. And there's absolutely no question that the civilian capacities were not there to do the kind of quick work that needed to be done in the wake of military intervention, to be frank. Military, external interventions destroy things, and there you go. I think that there is some. I think there is some concern. I think I share the concern that sort of the DoD bureaucracy is getting rolling in this direction. And my answer is we should absolutely proceed with building up civilian capacities to do this. But that again is not necessarily mean big numbers. And so I think it's important to sort of have a nuanced position on that, or a nuanced approach to enhancing civilian abilities to work in this area. And we should, we're always planning for the last war, so we should not think that Iraq is going to be the future of this sort of work. There may be another Iraq out there, but let's hope not. And certainly that's not the norm. And the other thing I want to point out about the civilian, civilians should be careful of what they wish for. And so the actual physical danger of operating in a conflict zone is very real. And the idea of being independent of military, so there's dangers on all sides. To be associated with the military has protectors versus to be in those conflict zones without any protection really poses serious dangers for international, whether they're NGOs or civilian bilaterals or UN civilians across the board. And I think those are problems that have not been addressed very adequately, really, in thinking about the future of civilian state building. The last thing I'll say is that since one of the things that has happened in the last year or two since we finished the book, if you will, I want to two things I just want to say. One is I want to is it, I've noticed now that lots of national government leaders across the, in all kinds of weak states are now saying state building, build states is the answer, give us the money, not NGOs, and there's a, and international organizations are locking themselves in through the Paris Declaration and other things into these kinds of positions, which leave them supporting corrupt or authoritarian authorities. And so I think that the important, and so therefore I want to associate myself with the remarks of Sarah about civil society and checks on state power, that part of state building is really building up checks on state power as well, so that those can be legitimate in their societies. And I think that consultation with nationals in all of these stages of these things is going to be increasingly important. But we don't know how to do it very well, particularly in post-crisis or post-intervention settings, in a way that's effective and quick and still has some legitimacy. I think that the bond process was actually, in my view, very positive. Where we are on state building in Afghanistan doesn't reflect the quality of that process, in my view. But I think that thinking about that is going to be a real challenge for development agencies and security actors as well. And thank you all for coming.
Let me thank you as well. I would note that the civilian military working group that USIP has run for several years has produced guidelines on relations between the military and NGOs in non-permissive environments with respect to humanitarian operations, and that those guidelines are now being implemented by the U.S. military and by the NGOs. That group is starting to talk about development projects as well. Whether they will come to some sort of agreed guidelines isn't at all clear to me, but it is subject of active discussion. Let me thank this illustrious and really very informative panel that has given us a lot of tough questions and a few suggestions about answers. Thank you very much.
Really good book, actually. Thank you. You got to get it out there. Okay. Do it. Thank you.
Good. No,
it's a pleasure. Yeah. Failed state is a term I just don't know. Somalia is a failed state. It was for a number of years. But there are no, I mean, I just don't, we don't really know what a failed state is.
Why do we need to know the answer to that? Why do we need to know the answer to that?
I know.
Right. 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 Do you want to commit troops? Are you, which countries are you committing troops to? Absolutely. What else are you going to do? Economic sanctions. We have economic sanctions. They're not effective. What else? Give money. We can give money, but it's not going to do anything with strengthening the rules. Well, no. Sending troops, the AU could send troops.
Why don't they?
But they don't.
Well, they could. They do in Darfur.
No, I haven't been here.
I agree.
And I wouldn't be anybody.
Right.
I think that
I don't really follow Zimbabwe, and I don't have an answer for Zimbabwe, but I think, I mean, those are big questions that should be asked, and I don't have any easy answers, frankly, for what can be done about Zimbabwe, honestly.
So, I just thought I would kind of repeat. So when you say there's no government, there's no state.
I just don't use the term because I don't think we really agree on what a failed state is. So
yeah.
I don't think there's any agreement about what that is. So.
Who's we?
We analysts or policymakers, either. So. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
How is
I'm sorry.
I would like to do that. So
it's a pleasure to meet you, and I enjoyed it.